In the last talk, I told you about the reason why vernacular literatures are also very important as a source and why it is not a good idea to set aside all the vernacular literatures as ahistorical or mythical stories. One of the first historians to have actually considered vernacular literatures as source was Aziz Ahmed. It's not that in the past vernacular literatures were not used. In fact, Aziz Ahmed, he wrote a very important piece which became became debatable among the historical circle. And this was titled as Epic and Counter Epic in Medieval India. In that article, Aziz Ahmed, he sees two literary growths in India from the time of invasion of the Turks. And in his construction, there is a Muslim epic of conquest and a Hindu counter epic of resistance. So he sees these Hindu counter epic of resistance, all the vernacular literature which were written in the local languages, or for that matter in Hindi, in Awadhi, or in Sanskrit. Aziz Ahmed sees it as some kind of a psychological rejection of the Turks. Now these two constructions are actually were considered by Aziz as mutually exclusive religious and cultural historical attitudes. Now, while he's discussing about this, he's also referring to a few of the non-vernacular texts. That is, he's talking about those, the Muslim epics of conquest, and as an example, he gives a reference to Khazain al-Futuh, which was written by Amul Khusro, which is a glorification of a Khalji conquest of Chittor. Similarly, he talks about New Sifir, which was again written by Amir Khusro, and it is a war epic on Mubarak Khalji. Then he talks about Tughlaqnama, which is again of Amir Khusro, and it is about the conquest of Ghiyasuddin Tughlaq. And another work which Aziz mentioned is Futuh al-Salatin, which was written by Isami, and it is again a glorification of Turkey conquest. Now he says that the two attitudes, the attitudes of Muslims and the Hindus, so the two attitudes developed in mutual ignorance of each other. So he's saying that these two variety of texts that were growing, one which is a epic of conquest for the Muslims and the other the counter epic of resistance of the Hindus, these were developing in ignorance of each other. So Aziz argues that each type confronted the other in aggressive hostility, and whose readership hardly ever converged. So they were being read in two different, communities, two different audiences. So the two, he gives example of two very significant texts in that regard as Epic of Resistance, and these are Amir Mahakavya and Padmavat. Although Aziz does not mention many other vernacular literatures, very significant ones, but later historians often think that Aziz Ahmed was actually clubbing all these vernacular literatures as a pick of counter-epic of resistance by the Hindus. Now, such an analysis of the two category of texts is purely based on the narrative that talk about the heroic confrontation between the Rajputs and the Muslim other. Now, recent analysis have shown that the rise of historical writing in Mid-Ganga Plain, or for that matter, even in Rajasthan, all these resulted from the desire to establish the order of ranking. Sometimes, in case of Rajasthan, you find that these are some order of ranking. Sometimes, these are also believed to be giving message to the local communities. So, all these literatures were basically composed at a time when Delhi Sultanate was dominant and the regions were trying to establish its presence. So, regional and the local rulers attracted the poets to their dynastic center, and so that they could praise their accomplishments. And that's how these vernacular literatures were composed. For example, Padmavat was composed at a time when Sher Shah was trying to establish himself as the ruler of North India and Eastern India also. If you remember in the last talk, I mentioned that the Prabandha Kavyas and the Prema Khyans had one commonality, and that is the impression of hyperbole to keep the audience interested. So, and you know, this is something which has been mentioned by many modern historians over the last two decades who have been working on various vernacular literatures. Now, these vernacular literatures texts were didactic with some message which was understandable to the local audience. Or, you know, when I'm saying talking about the local audience, I'm talking about the vernacular speaking community. So, these vernacular texts basically were masquerading as entertaining stories. And all the vernacular literatures, if you read minutely, were written in certain context. But then obviously the context was something there, they're always there, but they were written as some kind of entertaining stories. In other words, they were obviously didactic works masquerading as entertainments, and there were two important ingredients in the stories that were there in the vernacular texts. They were all moving stories, and these were done to keep the audience attached to the story. For, you know, attachment to the story means that the audience doesn't know what will happen next, so it keeps the audience glued to the story. So every day when the audience comes and sits together to listen to the vernacular texts that were actually recited orally at that time, the audience was actually attracted to come together and listen to those stories together. Now, the beauty of the story also lies in the way it is told. So that was also there in many of the vernacular texts. So vernacular texts in some way was acting like a media at that time. So it was a media of that time, in fact, like we see the many television shows or many serials, or for that matter in many, you know, serials in the Netflix or prime time nowadays. So this was another kind of a media of the time which was being composed in the 15th and the 16th centuries. When it comes to the Prema Khyans, there are three linked historical processes in the Prema Khyans. Number one, that it's a cultural assimilation and transformation. Number two, the creation of a new literary media. And third, the articulation of a spiritual practice using local terms and concepts. I mentioned in my last talk that there are four major Prema Khyans, the Chandayan, Mrigavati, Padmavat and Madhumaldi. which were written in 1379, 1503, 1540, and 1545 respectively. Now these vernacular literatures, which are known as Premakyans, these are basically love stories. And one of the interesting fact about these Premakyans is that most of them were written by Sufi saints. This is something that astonished many historians working on literary culture. The Sufi, the Islamic mystics of medieval and early modern times taught through their spiritual and worldly practices in these literary texts. Now, they illustrated through the composition and recitation of their verse romances, which were written in Hindvi, or what we call as Avadhi. And they were sung in front of the local communities. Now the challenge before the Sufi saints when they were trying to come up with their ideas and thoughts before the local communities, their challenge was to make their spiritual agenda comprehensible and appealing at the same times in that particular landscape. So that's why we find that most of these Premakyans, they used local terms, symbols, sometimes the concepts, and also techniques, and many a times even they refer to gods. So these Premakyans were written and performed in the eastern provinces of the Mid-Ganga Basin, and they were written in Avadhi, and so they were basically, these Premakyans were of these Sufi romances, which marked the inauguration of a new literary and devotional culture in a local language. Now the poems were recited in the evening in an elegant storytelling sessions, and these, as I mentioned, these were entertaining stories, and many a times you will also find erotic narratives in those Premakyans. We must understand that the historical agents during the medieval period were not just the courtiers of the kings and the sultans who wrote in Persian. The historical agents were also the Sufi disciples, and they were guided by the sheikhs. And these Sufi sheikhs also played the role of kingmakers many a times by maintaining some kind of a calculated distance from the royal courts. So these sheikhs also trained their disciples in spiritual exercises, and sometimes through music and poetry. They wrote these romances by drawing a local language, and in Sufi hospice, the erotic attributes of heroine and the seductive description of the love play were understood differently. So it was some kind of a method of literary analysis in which words and expressions were the expression of some kind of external reality, and they were excluded as historical in the historical context. Now these stories, these romantic love stories, they were understood logicentrical, as referring ultimately to God. When I'm saying using the word logicentrical, it means it's a kind of a term that we can use for describing a relationship between some kind of thought of the Sufis and the speech and the writings of the Sufis. So, in that sense, the Prema Khyans are need to be understood with their context. They need to be understood as some kind of compositions which were carrying some kind of philosophy and ideas with them. That's why Aditya Behel, in his book Love Subtle Magic, he talks about all these the Prema Khyans having three linked historical processes, as I mentioned earlier. He talks about the cultural assimilation and transformation. He talks about the creation of literary media, and then he talks about the articulation of the spiritual practices using the local terms and practices. Now, when it comes to the creation of literary, new literary language, we need to understand that that within the complex cultural landscape in which Persian were classical cosmopolitan tongue, that predefined some kind of generic and poetic expressions. These were not the sole expressions. Like the Persians were not the sole expressions or the sole means of expression at that time, and it should be understood by us. So a range of new literary languages and cultures were created, what Sheldon Pollack has termed as the vernacular millennium. So the question arises that why Awadhi as a language was being used. Now, by expressing themselves in these newly emergent media, the Sufi saints, the Sufi sheikhs were participating in some kind of a literary and linguistic transformation of the period the kind of world that they were thinking of. They created an Indian Islamic literary tradition using all these desi kind of terms and stories which were confined to a particular landscape like the Mid-Ganga Basin. And many times these Sufi sheikhs were, sometimes they were Chishtis, sometimes the Shattaris. As you know about the Chishtis, they came from Afghanistan. The Shattaris came from Persia. Now, one of the question that arises, that even both for the Chishtis and the Shattaris, it is often the Awadhi which was chosen as the language in Eastern India for writing such Prema Khyans. When it comes to the cultural assimilation part, the composition by a Muslim author to use the local language to express message was seen as a process of cultural assimilation. We also need to see the possibly the Sufi authors were carving out their own territories of spiritual jurisdiction, like the expanding Delhi Sultanate or the regional sultanates. And when we minutely read the sophisticated romances in the texts like Padmavat, we find that the local mythologies, the narratives, and the religious practices were used to express the competitive agenda of the Sufi love. And as literary media, we have already discussed about this, that how it these vernacular literatures, the Prema Khyans, worked as some kind of a literary media of its time. And the compositions like Jaisi's Padmavat, they were written originally in Persian script, but the language used was local vernacular. So the script was Persian, but the language was vernacular. And they were circulated, the idea behind writing these vernaculars in a particular local language was that it was targeted for the circles beyond the Sufi saints or the Sufi sheikhs, because such texts were got, and in fact we find that many later on these texts were also copied down in various other scripts, like we find that in later on in the Devanagari or Kathi scripts as well. Meaning thereby that they were also copied down for Hindu elites. So in this talk, what we have learned is that the Premakhyans, like Padmavat, had three linked historical processes. Number one, it was some kind of a creation of literary media. The Sufi sheikhs used the local languages like Avadi with the Desi terms in it, and there were some kind of literatures of assimilation of the local communities. They were written by Persian speaking Sufis to reach out to the rural Hindus. It was a cultural assimilation for the reason because of the very use of the local language and terms to express the message of love by Sufis was a process of cultural assimilation. And when we talk of the third character of the Premakhyan like Padmavat, is that it's an articulation of spiritual practice, because the Sufi sheikhs, or for that matter Malik Muhammad Jaisi, uses local language and terms. The local mythologies and religious practices have been used by Jaisi to express the agenda of Sufi love. Having said that, the historical agents who were part of the Indian Islamic literary culture were not just the courtiers and the kings of the Delhi or Agra. The disciples of the Sufi orders also were the historical agents at that time, and they were basically commanding spiritual jurisdiction over different parts of the territory of Hindustan, particularly in the mid-Ganga basin.